Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the May 12, 2011 Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. We've got a full agenda today. We're going to start off with a public hearing on House Bill 3250. Representatives and Senator.
I'll sit on the far right.
Are you comfortable on the far right?
You know me.
She's
from up here,
probably
you're on the far
fairly
left.
Comfortable.
Representative, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and honorable colleagues. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53, and glad to be joined this afternoon with two fine representative and senator to help bring you this House Bill 3250, the Keep Kids Safe License Plate Bill. Mr. Chair, I really do appreciate you hearing this bill. And I hope each member has looked at the handout from the coalition that comes from each of your county commissions on children and families or children and families commissions. It's a concise letter addressing the major issues. This is an austere budget year, and I want to stress that with this bill, there's no cost to the state. However, our state funding of child abuse prevention programs is down about 20%, I understand. Each of us are mandatory reporters of suspected child abuse. Remember our first week in this building this year, and every year we get briefed about that. It is an issue of critical concern. I think some of us in here are also at the relief nurseries this week reception. Relief nurses are an Oregon program of success which would benefit from profits from the license plates. The money raised will go to the Children's Trust Fund, which is a private, nonprofit trust fund, and it is not sweepable. Representative Boone will talk. She's a member of that board, and she'll talk about that. Senator Telfer, my local county commission, Children and Families Commission, came up with this idea, and they worked hard, actually, for three sessions. And they worked in trying to research not only the idea, but how to successfully market the plate. And they have a great marketing plan that they'll talk to you about. Mr. Chair and members, we really ask you to let this bill go forward. Let these volunteers have the opportunity to market this plate for child abuse prevention programs. This plate can not only raise funds for child abuse prevention programs, but also brings awareness to the issue. And that justifies the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Who's next?
Okay, Chris.
Oh, thank you.
Senator.
Well, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for taking the opportunity to hear this bill. I'm here mostly to show my support for the bill. I think Representative Wisnett pretty much captured most of which needs to be said. But I can tell you this goes to an important need, addresses a need of abused children, particularly with these budget cuts. But the good news is this is going to cost the state no money. And if it sells one plate, it's still money going towards child abuse. If it sells 5,000 plates, that's a lot of money. So, and again, appreciate you taking the having the willingness to hear the bill. There are a lot of people in this room that know more about this bill and can convey its urgency to you. So I will not use your valuable time. I just want you to know that highly supportive of the bill, and thank you again for giving us the opportunity to convey our concerns with it.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. And I'm back up here for, I think, the third time now with my buddy from the central part of our state. Sorry? Oh. Deborah Boone, House District 32, the beautiful upper left coast, which probably looks even sunnier than this. I have served on the Children's Trust Fund for years now, and before that, I was a charter member of the Oregon chapter for the National Committee for Prevention of Child Abuse. I used to be able to say it in one breath. They've changed their names now, but what we do is we fund primary prevention of child abuse programs, relief nurseries, we support the commissions, tons and tons of programs, and it's a great. This is a great way to get a little bit more of the money spread around the state. I know for a fact that people are lining up at DMVs as we speak to buy this license plate. So I hope that you consider it favorably. If you have need any more information about the Children's Trust Fund, I'd be happy to talk to you at some other time offline. I have nothing but good things to say about it, and I want to thank Senator Telfer and Representative Wisnett for bringing this bill before you again. And as a member of the board, I would bring my board support as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions of this illustrious group? Guess not. You got off easy. We'll let you go back to work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I've got a long list of people here. And I would ask, because we've got a lot to go through today, so those who come up, if you could keep your comments as short as possible and get your message across, it'd be appreciated. Beth Slater, Bill Davidson, and Bill Thomas.
Just get going, keep it short and sweet. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I am Elizabeth Slater. I work with CFM Strategic Communications, and we represent the Coalition of County Children and Families Commissions. Today we bring you, with all respect, House Bill 3250, the Keep Kids Safe License Plate. And this bill comes to you on a unanimous vote from the House Human Services Committee and a 51-8 vote on the House floor. House Bill 3250 gives DMV permission to print a unique background on a group license plate, where normally the plate would have a tree and a sticker. The money goes through the Children's Trust Fund, a private nonprofit fund, and out to local commissions on a formula-driven basis to fund child abuse prevention programs. We have worked with the DMV, Children's Trust Fund, and local commissions on children and families to draft a bill that will give us the best opportunity to make money for child abuse prevention services. In addition to funding those services, the unique background on this license plate is a visual reminder that child abuse and neglect are a problem in our state. Awareness is a key point to prevention. As Bill Davidson, chair of the Deschutes County Commission on Children and Families, will tell you, the staff there have worked for more than 6 years to develop this bill. They researched the fundraising potential of Oregon's license plates. They looked at the popularity of plates similar to Keep Kids Safe in other states. They talked to DMV staff many times to determine the startup costs, and they asked DMV what they would need to do to ensure their success. They found a private donor to fund the $40,000 startup costs. We have the District Attorney's Association, the Sheriff's Association, and the Police Chief's Association's support for this bill, as well as many other associations. And we also have a letter from Tanya Hunt, Representative Hunt's wife, who runs the Clackamas County Children's Center, who qualify for these funds based on her provision of child abuse prevention services. And I will pass that letter around. I'll pass it to the committee administrator. I know you guys are savvy about license plates and you've dealt with them a lot. The good thing about this is there's no skin off the state's back on this plate. If they fail, it's their money. If they succeed, though, they are funding important child abuse prevention services around the state. So we ask for your support for this bill and a vote to pass it to the Senate floor. Thank you very much.
Can you speak to the marketing plan, or who will do that?
Bill Davidson, who's at the Deschutes County Children and Families Commission, can do that.
All right.
Good afternoon, Senator Beyer, Senator Atkinson, and committee members. I'm Bill Davidson, a citizen chair of the Deschutes County Children and Families Commission. I'm also the citizen vice chair of the Coalition of County Children and Families Commission. Thank you for holding this hearing today. I am here today to respectfully request you vote affirmatively to send House Bill 3250 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. This bill is a grassroots effort begun in Deschutes County. It is an effort to secure sustainable revenue to fund prevention efforts relative to child abuse and neglect. It has been embraced by citizens, children and family commissions, and providers that operate prevention programs for child abuse and neglect in all 36 counties. The source of sustainable revenue from this legislation would come from those citizens who voluntarily purchase the license plate. A recent web poll found that 86% of survey respondents indicated they would purchase such a license plate. There is no cost to implement this license plate to the state of Oregon. The Oregon Commission on Children and Families has agreed to provide $10,000 refundable application fee. The private donor, along with the Deschutes County Children and Families Commission, has agreed to provide $29,000 for programming and setup fees. This same private donor has agreed to provide another $5,000 to launch a marketing plan. A statewide marketing plan has been developed to get the widest distribution of these of this new license plate. Research has shown the most successful license plates are those that have a marketing plan. Our estimate indicates there would be a revenue of $100,000 available each biennium to distribute to counties. The revenue generated from sales of license plate will flow to local communities through a proposed private-public partnership. The Children's Trust Fund of Oregon would receive sales revenue from the Department of Motor Vehicles quarterly. The Children's Trust Fund would distribute this revenue to counties biannually. A formula would provide a base amount to each county. Added to this base amount would be an additional prorated share of the funds based on the number of license plates each county sells. This revenue estimate is conservative and was based on the experience generated by the Share the Road license plate. Share the Road license plate collects a smaller surcharge and does not collect a surcharge on renewal. Thus, using this model suggests that the estimate is quite conservative. Each county would determine how to invest their share of revenue to support child abuse and neglect prevention programs. This money would be used to leverage additional funds for these types of programs. Research shows for every dollar spent on prevention programs, saves an average of $5 over time. This would be revenue counties do not currently have and may help to sustain programs that would be lost due to the economic environment in which we currently find ourselves today. Please give this grassroots effort a chance to thrive and bear fruit. Don't let it die. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Beyer and Vice Chair Atkinson and members of the committee, my name is Bill Thomas. I'm director of the Washington County Commission on Children and Families, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of the commission. The commission has endorsed this bill, and they request your affirmative vote to send it to the floor with a due pass. Let me be brief and make just 2 points. Number one is that the estimate of $100,000 may not sound like a lot, but we know that you have to make very difficult budget choices, and many important and critical programs will be cut this biennium. This money will go to communities. It will be magnified because it will be leveraged by community-based programs. So every dollar counts, and this will help programs that prevent child abuse. In April was National Child Abuse Prevention Month. This little blue ribbon I'm wearing was a symbol of that. We were able to get every municipality in Washington County, from King City and Tigard and to Forest Grove and Hillsborough, to fly a flag this month, which said, we stand united against child abuse. It's never happened. It's something that has to be magnified as well. And this, as Beth had indicated, a license plate may not sound like a lot, but it's a visual statement. It's a way that ordinary citizens can fly a little flag on their car. They can send a message that keeping kids safe and preventing child abuse is important to them. We urge your vote on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of this panel? Thank you very much. Megan Stoley, Stacy Michelson, and Helen Lucas. Whoever wants to go first.
I can go first. Chair Beyer and committee members, my name is Helen Lucas. I am a CASA volunteer in Lane County, and I work for an organization called A Family for Every Child. I am also a past president of Committed Partners for Youth and a past president of the former Wainema Girl Scout Council in Southern Oregon. When I heard about this bill, I thought it was a no-brainer. After all, we have license plates to save salmon for sports teams, veterans, national monuments, and even bicyclists. What could be more important than supporting our children? Then I learned that this bill has been turned down on two other occasions, and I was stunned. Child abuse is epidemic in Oregon today, and more children than ever are being parented by the state. Even if this plate brought in just $1,000 for any one organization that works with these children, that would be impactful. As an example, that small amount of money could pay the expenses for a trained volunteer or even some printed material. I've learned that there is a 3-year marketing plan in place for this plate. I am convinced that the proceeds would have an impact on children that I and all of my counterparts work so hard to support and protect, those children most in need and those children that the state parents. I still can't believe that this is not a no-brainer. I strongly urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Stacey Michelson, Policy Associate with Children First for Oregon. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here because Children First's mission is to make Oregon a place where all children are healthy and safe and have the resources they need to thrive. It's for that reason that I'm here in support of House Bill 3250 today. Children First is the parent organization of the Oregon Foster Youth Connection. I am actually also wearing a blue ribbon this month. Ours is in recognition of National Foster Care Awareness Month. And unfortunately, the child welfare system is where a lot of our kids who have been victims of abuse and neglect end up. And in partnership with the OFYC, I not only work closely with a lot of youth who have firsthand experience with abuse and neglect, but also with organizations like our local CASAs who help provide services and protect the kids who end up in the foster care system. The individuals in these groups can attest much more than I can sitting up here to the need for programs like this, like the plate. And to the fact that child abuse is a big issue in our state, though the statistics also speak for themselves, I'll give you a quick overview of that. In the last year, 2010, there were over 13,000 children in foster care with an average daily number of 8,700 and over 11,000 confirmed instances of abuse and neglect. At Children First, we believe that's simply too many, and that if there's anything we can do to help protect kids, especially at no cost to the state, it's something we should be doing. I think that these plates will help raise awareness of the fact that child abuse is a major issue in our state, and yes, also hopefully raise some funds for these local organizations that are helping to serve our kids. If the budget's being cut, the services that these local organizations provide are even more vitally important. You know, across the board, we're talking about everyone tightening their belts, reducing budgets, and Oregonians sort of pulling together to share in the sacrifice. Well, here we've got local groups that are trying to fill that gap for us and to help help provide those services that the state just can't quite meet. So if at no cost to the state, we can help them do that a little bit better and provide a few more services to our kids, we think that's something we should be doing, and I urge you to support 3250. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of this group? Thank you. Oh, Representative Gillum. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Vic Gillum from District 18. Silverton, Molalla. I did not mean to disrupt your committee today, but one of your colleagues to your immediate left insisted that I come forward. I am happy to offer these brief words. I know these license plate bills can be annoying. This is a good one. We spent a great deal of time on it. You can't find a finer representative or a finer group of people with a finer cause than the one you'll hear about, and I highly recommend that you listen carefully and that you pass this bill.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr.
Any
Chair.
Questions of the good representative?
Not if he's going to be that serious.
Thank you. Let's see here. I have
not for the record, I'm not sure.
Sid Johnson, and I think it's Keegan Walsh. Yeah. And if Megan Stoley is here, still stuck in traffic.
Thank you. Chairman Beyer,
Vice Chairman Atkinson, members of the committee, thank you very much for having this hearing and providing us the opportunity to testify. My name is Sid Johnson. I am a CASA volunteer and member of the Board of Directors of Lane County CASA. I have spent my career helping shape national policy to support children and prevent child abuse, starting as an aide to Walter Mondale when he was Senator and Vice President, and ending as President and CEO of Prevent Child Abuse America. It is an epidemic, and it's worse because of the recession. The cases go up and the funding goes down. I know firsthand the benefits of CASA. We help prevent re-abuse, and we help speed up, when appropriate, movement of children from foster care to safe and permanent homes. As you know, foster care in Oregon for one child for 1 year costs $25,000. We have helped in the last year alone save the taxpayers $500,000 by moving, when appropriate, these children to safer homes. This bill would help us plug the hole in funding, and I hope very much you will support it and move it forward to the Senate floor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Beyer, Senators. Thank you for listening to all of us this afternoon. I would have to say that now that I know I'm the last speaker, it has been unanimous. All the speakers in front of you have been for this bill. I would like to say that I'm also a CASA from Lane County. I'm also on the board of directors for sponsors in Eugene, a reentry program. And people ask me, how can I do both? And I say, well, if I can catch them when I'm a CASA, I can hopefully prevent them from meeting them later in sponsors. When you buy a license plate for Salmon, the $10 that goes to that group goes to Salmon, a whole $10. That $10 that would go to child prevention, child abuse prevention, to CASA, any of the other agencies, translates into $184.30. That's using a national figure that's what a volunteer's hour is worth, $18.43. So for every $10, it projects out to $184.30 per hour. $10 per hour is $184.30. These are figures that are easier to take in. It was mentioned earlier $100,000 would go to child abuse prevention or to CASA or other agencies. That translates to $1,800,000. They desperately need that money, and it doesn't cost you a dime to pass this bill. I urge you to pass this bill. And if I were up on your side of the table, I would say I'd like to make a motion that we pass this bill. Do I have a seconder, please? Thank you.
I guess I just have a question. Maybe you guys are not the right ones to ask it, but if not, maybe someone else will. But the real question is, I spent a lot of time yesterday, because I was curious, looking at how you would market this and looking at the website and to do this. And quite frankly, it's almost impossible to find the plates that you want on the DMV website to know how deep no one of these exists. Looks like there's about 100 permutations of plates that you could get. Obviously, the three big plates are the Crater Lake plate, the Cultural Trust, and the Salmon plate. Those are the ones that most people know. Those are the ones that are marketed. Unless you really know that this thing is available, there's no way you would know if you went online or if you went into a DMV office that it was even available. So the real question of these plates, in general, all of these plates together are called group plates, or I forget the name for the signature plates, but only about 10% of the plates sold sell with one of these. And it's, how would you even know they existed?
I run on the internet as well, Chairman, and was frustrated. And I'm not in charge of the marketing plan. If I were, and you can ask the gentleman who spoke earlier, I would have a separate website. I would market it to every children's organization
and ask them to market it to their supporters, their volunteers, their staff, their friends and neighbors, word of mouth. I would start with the people who are already committed to children and make sure they knew about it. Website would be helpful as well, but that's the way I would do it.
Okay. You must be Megan.
My name's Megan Stoley.
Sure.
Yes. Chair Beyer, I'm here to talk with you about Bill 36.
Could you pull the microphone over close so we can get it on the tape, please?
Thank you. My name's Megan. I'm here to talk with you about Bill 3250. And I actually received services recently through the Children's Relief Nursery and DHS, and I'm in partnership with PCC right now, and I came straight from a job interview, which I'm very happy that I'm actually moving towards self-sustainability. And I had to go and apply for a DV grant. I got out of a situation, a trying living situation with my partner of 4 years, who I upheld and supported a couple businesses of his, but we had a child. And in that relationship, I was very compromised. I actually got to the point where my health, safety, and well-being was at risk, as well as my own child's. So I didn't really know where to go, but the Children's Relief Nursery took me in and advocated for me, and I went to the Gateway Center, and now I have a family support advocate through Family Support Network. I ran in here late. Sorry. Please excuse me.
Good time.
But my son is three now, and I'm 38. I'll be 38, actually, Friday, tomorrow. But he just turned three, and he was experiencing extraordinary distress and regressions. He was stuttering. I got very, very sick in the relationship. I didn't even know what panic attacks were. I developed like a growth in my thyroid and in my lymph node, and I dropped down to 116 pounds. I went to the doctor and realized that I was having severe anxiety attacks. So my mental health and my physical health were very compromised in this controlling relationship because I was psychologically manipulated and was very abusive. So now I'm recovering, and I'm in therapy at the Center for Health and Healing at OHSU. And I actually have gotten trained to do some advocacy work, and I'm looking forward to just redeveloping myself, redefining myself, and I'm back on a career path and back in school. And I just wanted to come here to speak about children because I've been a nanny for years and an early childhood educator. I adore kids, you know. And my son is just, early intervention is so critical. He turned around like nobody's business. I mean, luckily I have a support system with my family, so I'm back in my home with my parents unexpectedly, not the outcome I had expected, but I just came here to speak about the services that were provided to me being like a miracle, and I feel so confident right now when I felt like I was just teared apart at the seams and didn't quite know how to pick myself up, but with the support that I've gotten through Children's Relief Nursery in particular, is how I got here today. I'm back on track.
Thank you, Megan.
Question.
Senator Edwards.
For the folks from Lane County CASA, what's the estimate of Lane County CASA's take from this?
We have 160 CASAs working right now. We have over 300 trained, some have taken break. I personally am taking a break right now. I just finished my sixth case in 4 years.
You're shared the revenue.
We have no idea what our share of the revenue is. But I'll tell you the one thing. It cost me about $25 in gas to come up here. If we get 26 out of the deal, I'll be happy. I mean, it's every dollar that we bring in goes to working with children. We save the state a tremendous amount of money. For every child that's in foster care who has a CASA...
No, I got that. That's not my question.
In response to that question, I don't know. I would want to work with a gentleman who had that estimate of $100,000. I do believe that Lane County will receive the proportionate amount of the Lane County residents who purchased these license plates as a portion of the state. And I can guarantee you, we will work very, very hard to get high purchasing in Lane County.
Wouldn't it just be easier to ask them to donate $25 than to buy a license plate on top, add another $25 on top of the license plate they're going to purchase?
We aren't shy about asking for support, as you know, in a variety of means. So I'd like to have a menu for people to support. So this would be a nice supplement.
If I had a hat right now, I'd pass it around the room and say, please put some money in for CASA. I'm not shy.
Believe me, I know that in Lane County.
No. And I know of at least one senator up here whose family donates money to CASA every year. And I'm not going to mention their name.
Thank you very
You're
much.
Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having
me. Amy Joyce, are you here?
Well done.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation is here to testify on House Bill 3250.
Yet another license plate.
I was going to say, here again to talk about license plates this session. We talked earlier in the session about Senate Bill 442, the Wine Country Plate. Handing out some written testimony and a couple of attachments there. I'll just hit a couple of points since you've heard about license plates from me before. You're correct, Chair Beyer, noting that about 90% of Oregonians have the standard tree plate on their vehicle, and of the remaining 10%, there are a number of different plates. Two types of plates are fundraiser specialty plates and group plates. This would be a group plate. Specialty are currently Salmon Cultural Trust and Crater Lake, which came to us through the efforts of Senator Atkinson, and the most recent Pacific Wonderland, which is a limited duration specialty plate. There are 38 different group plates available currently, which are from 13 different groups. There are 26 different military or veteran plates currently under the group system. The estimate, I believe, they provided, typically a group plate costs about $27,000 to set up because there would be a unique background with this Keep Kids Safe plate. The estimate is a little bit higher than that. $10,000 of that is an application fee that's statutory that is refunded to the group if they sell 1,000 plates in the first year. And groups have to sell or renew at least 500 plates a year to keep their group active. From 2004 to 2007, the average revenue distribution for a group was $4,000 or $5,000 a year. In 2008, there was the addition of the Share the Road, the bicycle group plate, as well as sort of an expansion of the veterans group. So the average has gone up to about $7,000 or $8,000 per group per year. Initial costs to set up a new group plate have to be paid by the group, which they mentioned. And I would call your attention to attachment one, which is the sort of a, looks a little bit like an organizational chart. It's the various specialty and group plates currently available and ones that have sort of fallen off the map for lack of sales. And on the back of that, sales by year of plates, all the various group plates can be seen there with totals at the bottom. And the third attachment, revenues for the various specialty plates, the current four, and the various group plates, so you can see the numbers of revenues over the course of the years. And I would mention, too, that in 2003, the legislature did significantly change the plate laws for the state. The body limited the number of specialty plates that can be offered to a maximum of three at one time. And the group plate limitation, groups had to sell at least 500 per year rather than the old 50 to stay active. And the legislature also that year added the $10,000 application fee as a way, I think, to encourage
people to think quite judiciously before starting this process. And the changes were done as a streamlining effort as well in 2003. So 3250 creates the kids' group plate, comes under the group plate system. Folks have mentioned funds up front and the notion of a advertising plan or promotion plan. The department can't promote a plate on behalf of others, so the existence of that from the group is, as they mentioned, is likely critical to the ability to sell a number of plates to make it worthwhile. That's what I have.
So what would, if I were buying, if this was available now and I were buying plates, what would be my total cost?
Chair Beyer, the current two-year registration renewal is $86, I believe.
So $86, and then you'd add the...
You would add to that whatever the surcharge amount is that the group decides to come up with. Statutorily, it can range anywhere from $10 per renewal period up to $64 per renewal period. There's also a $23 plate manufacturing fee, so rather than when we renew our plates, normally if you're just renewing your existing plate, you get a sticker in the mail. The plate manufacturing fee covers the actual manufacture of the physical plate, as well as part of that money as part of the Jobs and Transportation Act.
So I believe the bill calls for $32.
Okay.
I think it's $32 for 2 years. Is that right?
Isn't in the bill. Okay.
So is it? So it's 86. So that would be like $118 then, or is there? Did you say there's an additional charge?
86, the 23 manufacturing fee, and the 32 group fee
plus
is 511, 10, 141. I believe is what
so
I come up with.
$141 is what it would cost you if you wanted this plate.
I believe that's correct, Chair Beyer.
And if you already had plates, how would you get them? If you wanted to buy these to replace what you had.
You could, if folks were to wait to their normal renewal time when they get their registration renewal in the mail, they would write on that that they wanted to change to the kids' plate and send in the appropriate amount of money, mail that back in, and a couple of weeks later the plate shows up in the mail. They can also do that if you're not at renewal time. You can come into the DMV field office, fill out a form, say I want the kids' plate, and again in a couple of weeks it would get mailed to you.
Okay. Someone, you'd have to be dependent on the mailing or the marketing program done independently of DMV.
That's correct, Chair Beyer. The only plate options that show up on a mailed renewal are just the standard tree or the three existing specialty plates. None of the group plates show up on your registration renewal. You have to know of its existence and sort of call it out to receive that plate. They are on the website. There's a click to go to plates, and you can see all the many different kinds of plates that exist. But you have to know that it's there and then write it in rather than checking a box even.
So as I recall, in the last legislative session, the legislature authorized two new plates, the Pacific Wonderland Limited Edition plate.
Correct.
And the Share the Road bike plate.
Correct.
So how many of the Wonderland plates were ordered?
Our numbers just updated through, I believe, March. It's approximately 8,000 of the 40,000 sets have been sold.
So we printed 40,000 and sold 8.
Chair Beyer, I don't know that we've printed the whole 40,000 yet, but that's the limit for that program, but only about 8 have sold in the 12 months.
How about the Share the Road would be the one closest to this, right?
Chair Beyer, that's correct. Let's see if I can find that on the chart here. It looks like approximately, I would say about 10,000 have been sold total. Starting, those began in 2008 to be sold.
What was the cost for that one?
Share the Road, I think, is a $30. Senator Atkinson may know better than I. But I believe it might be a $30 fee, but I don't have that right off the top of my head.
Oh, okay. $30, okay. And
how are we doing on sales of plates? I assume most of them happen with new cars.
Right. So, Chair Beyer, most specialty plates in particular are purchased by folks when they get a new car rather than at renewal. For group, we don't have those numbers specifically, but it seems to be, you know, probably not as many, but and more tied to maybe the group itself. But plate sales overall are down. Registrations are down, and sales of specialty and group overall are down as well.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I have a question.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you. I'm looking for clarification on the difference with the group plates. Are most of those insignias that, or some other designs stamped on one of our other standard plates, except for Share the Road?
Right. Chair Beyer and Senator Edwards, the group plate, as it was sort of conceived and as most of them exist, are on the tree background and then have some kind of wording or an insignia on there. This proposal in this bill, as well as the Share the Road, were sort of called out as having a unique background, like a specialty plate, but under the group provision of the law. But the vast majority of them are on just a tree background with an insignia or words.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Amy. Let's see here. Bill Davidson, were you the one who addressed the marketing?
Sure.
I mean, just very quickly, if you could share your idea about how you're going to market this plate. Please, and if I'm sounding a bit skeptical, it's not in any way skeptical about the cause or the need to put money there. It's just a question about, we get a lot of people who want a new plate thinking this will be the greatest way to generate money, and usually they don't recover the cost of printing the plate.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Chair Beyer, we have a marketing plan. Actually, I have it in my hand right here. The marketing plan includes direct mails. We would do that through distribution with the Commission on Children and Families, local Commission on Children and Families, and use our the people that we are in contact with. We would have website promotion from the Children and Families websites. We'd have media work done in terms of press releases, PSAs that we could pay for. So there would be paid selective paid advertising in terms of print, television, radio, and other media. We would do documents for point of sale with car dealerships. We would do a traveling display that could be used at various types of occasions. And community outreach through speaking engagements. Now, there is an incentive in this bill, as you understand, for each county, because they get a base amount and then they get so much more for what they have sold in terms of plate. So it incentivizes each county to get out and to market this particular license plate. So the speaking to community groups and that kind of thing would in a local area would help.
Okay. Any other questions? Do you want to comment, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. Mr. Chair, I think your questions are, you know, very important, and I know you're concerned. I think as Bill's talking about here, we've spent, the people in the commission have spent a lot of time going to other states and looking at this, and I don't know, hope the committee members picked up that the donor, our donor has also provided $5,000 as seed money to start this campaign. So, and he also mentioned Dick Widnell, many of you know, has dealerships in town. We're trying to get him to help us jump start this program by offering the tags, maybe as an incentive of new cars and things like that. So I think I understand your concern. I think that we've worked this so many years and put so much effort in it, we just want a chance to try. And it doesn't cost the state anything. If it doesn't work, it goes away. But I think the dedication, the enthusiasm is there, as Bill's explaining. We've looked at California. We've looked at Washington plans to try to move the thing. And I think Oregon should be proud. And I think, again, just by having that on your car, you're saying I'm concerned. And I think people will donate. I think they will want to have the tag on their car. But but well, it's to be seen. But I really do believe that they put forth the effort to look at this. They didn't just say, we'll go make millions of dollars. They based it on the share of the road and what they found out in California, I think, and some other states.
Well, 36 other states we looked at.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill?
Just for the record, there is a revenue statement and a fiscal statement, but it did not go through Ways and Means or revenue on the House side, and I talked to Ways and Means, and they're not requesting referral to Ways and Means on this.
Okay. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3250, and we'll take this one under advisement. Let's see what's next. We will open a work session on House Bill 2159. Colleagues, just the one we worked before the seed bill. I think we have everything now.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
I would move House Bill 2159 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill 2159 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion on the motion?
Which one is it?
Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion?
No.
There is none. With that, Senator Atkinson, I will congratulate you on your work on this bill. It took a long time. 2159 is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Atkinson will carry.
Giddy up.
Giddy up. And let's see, we will now move. We will open a... We'll close on 2159, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2622.
House Bill 2622 revises renewable portfolio standard to include an electricity generated from renewable energy source, provided the generating facility previously burned coal as a fuel source, ceased to do so, and converted to a renewable energy source after the effective date of the measure. I got a little, I did receive a -7 amendment from Representative Greg Smith, but I also received a letter from him asking the committee not to consider the -7 amendments.
Okay. We have two people signed up for this bill, Marion Hayes and Jeff Bissonette. No, three people.
Yeah. I'm going to crash the party.
All right. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first.
Marion?
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes. I represent Portland General Electric. House Bill 2622 is intended to address a very narrow issue in the renewable energy standard language, clarifying that the Department of Energy has the authority to allow the conversion of an existing facility that primarily burns coal, completely ceases burning coal, and converts to a new renewable fuel source to qualify under the standard. Some of you may know that Portland General Electric, the majority owner of Oregon's only coal-fired generating facility in the state, worked with its stakeholders on an agreement approved by the Environmental Quality Commission to stop using coal at Boardman no later than the end of 2020. This baseload resource provides approximately 15% of PGE's energy and is a workhorse in their generating fleet. It also provides 110 full-time jobs in Morrow County and over 200 jobs during seasonal maintenance. PGE is currently in the early stages of a significant R&D effort focused on using closed-loop agricultural biomass to fuel the facility. Should this prove out, the facility can be kept in service but use a renewable fuel source and continue to provide jobs in rural Oregon. When the Renewable Energy Standard was adopted in 2007, there was no talk about shutting down existing fossil fuel facilities. In order to encourage new renewable facilities, the legislature excluded old facilities in operation prior to 1995 from qualifying to meet the standard's requirements. This exclusion inadvertently forecloses the reuse of Boardman because it was erected prior to 1995, even if it converts to a renewable fuel source in the future. We don't believe this makes sense. Converting Boardman to a renewable energy resource is exactly the type of action that the Renewable Energy Standard was designed to encourage. It will create environmental benefits, increase fuel diversity, and encourage economic development. In fact, if a facility that looked just like Boardman were erected today as a biomass facility, there is no question as to whether it would qualify under the standard. This is simply a technical fix, and it only makes sense to try to reuse the existing plant. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marianne. Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We are here in support of House Bill 2622. We worked with PGE in a rulemaking process that ODO was having around this. Came pretty much to where this bill is until we discovered we didn't have the authority or the department wouldn't have the authority to implement it and as a rule, and so that's why we're here at the legislature to kind of clarify this. We worked very closely also with the Renewable Northwest Project, who's another key stakeholder in the development of the RPS. RNP couldn't have somebody here in person today, and so they authorized me to say that they too are in support of the bill and encourage your yes vote to move it to the Senate floor. I'll kind of stay at that high level, but I'd be happy to answer specific questions as they come up. Thank you.
Jeff?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lisa Pinero, I'm representing the Oregon Department of Energy. The department has worked with the proponents of the bill as well as various stakeholders and as well as the governor's office to understand the implications of House Bill 2622A on the renewable portfolio standard. It is the department's understanding that the changes in the bill will allow electricity that's generated by a facility who historically or that historically burned coal as its primary fuel source but then has switched to a renewable energy resource, that electricity will in fact qualify for the RPS. The intent of the bill, as we understand it, is narrow and very specific, and I just wanted to let you know that we do support the bill as it's written today. The governor's office has also asked me, since they could not have a staff person here today, to also convey that they will submit a letter of support of the bill and their understanding of the narrow and tight implications of this bill. Thank you.
So, Lisa, just to be real clear, this is a very narrow technical fix.
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. Very narrow.
I assume it primarily, in fact, the only one I could think that it would apply to would be the Boardman plant.
Mr. Chair, that is our understanding, and in the implementation of this, the department will treat it that way as well.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Senator Atkinson.
A couple of questions. Line 14 of the bill, line 14 of the House amendments. Completely ceases to burn coal as a fuel source. Do you envision there being a timeline that it's not burning fuel in order for it to qualify, or can they, at midnight it stops burning fuel or coal, and on 6 a.m. the next day it's renewable? Can it happen that fast? Or is there like a time of conversion? Or
well, we're Chair Beyer, Senator Atkinson, we're still in the fairly early stages of our R&D effort, but we will cease burning coal completely and permanently in Boardman no later than the end of 2020. Under the BART rule that was approved by the EQC, we're required to do that. So we have yet to do a test burn on the facility. That's scheduled for 2013, and we'll understand more about the way that biomass will work in the facility and how quickly we can potentially turn that fuel source around.
One more question.
Go ahead.
What happens if you're 2013, you're burning biomass, and 2020, there's a new hybrid type of coal out there that's great, and so convert back, then what happens? Do we have to, does that future legislature have to come back and say that no longer counts as the RPS if you switch back a second time?
Chair Beyer, Senator Atkinson, should there be a cleaner burning coal in the future, we'd have many significant steps and agencies that we'd have to revisit with. Again, the BART rule, it's the regional haze rule required under the Clean Air Act, requires us, and again, the EQC adopted this rule to stop burning coal in 2020, no later than 2020. The federal government will also approve that closure or that date for ceasing to burn coal. So we would have to go back and reopen that regional haze rule and the Clean Air Act compliance under that with the state, with the federal government, before we could even begin to think about whether if we were even able to use coal again, how that would work with this bill.
Thank you.
Senator, clarify from Lisa. I think you're asking different questions. One question was, could a plant return to burning coal? And I think that's separate from this bill. This talks about would a plant that used to burn coal and is now burning biomass qualify for meeting the Oregon Renewable Portfolio Standard. If you converted it back to something other than biomass, it wouldn't qualify. Is that correct, Lisa?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that is correct. I think that I would clarify that to say that the facility would necessarily have to burn a renewable fuel source. I don't know that it's specific to biomass. I'm looking at my colleagues here to confirmation on that.
Mr. Chair, that's actually you added the last half of that sentence in the question I didn't ask, but if you did convert, would it still qualify? And the answer is no, but I have a feeling that future legislatures are going to be looking at different definitions of what renewable is. And if you remember, the biggest fight we had over renewable was whether or not hydroelectricity was considered renewable or not. We have the biggest hydro resources in the United States, but we decided to not call them renewable. And I have a belief that that's going to come back up. Just anyway, thanks for the clarification.
Okay. Anything else for this group? No? Thank you very much. So is anybody else who, that's all I had on the list, is there anybody else who wishes to testify on 2622? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on 2622 and open a work session on 2622. Senator Atkinson?
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2622 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill 2622 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, House Bill 2622 is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. The chair will carry. We'll close on 2622 and we will, open on House Bill 2893. Richard.
House Bill 2893 revises the requirement for giving notice by a registered professional land surveyor or employee or agent of a land surveyor prior to the entry upon land for survey work purposes. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Thank you. I have Dan Winshed, if I said that right, and Fred Venata. Fred, you haven't been in front of our committee this year.
For the record, Chair Beyer, committee members, Dan Lynchide, Damhill County Surveyor out of McMinnville. This bill basically would do two things. It would allow private surveyors the ability to give written notice by mail. They do not have that ability now. This law was enacted in 1995, I believe, and we've got quite a record. I'm on the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineers and Land Surveyors, and I chair the Law Enforcement Committee there. And we get these private surveyors in front of us all the time. Many times they're just over spiteful things between the neighbors, but sometimes there has been a factual violation of our regulations and laws, and it has to do with the fact that they perhaps left their business card on a door or tried to call, but just telephonically. They use other methods than what's specified in 672-047. And so this bill would allow private surveyors the ability to submit written a written notice to the owner, and it makes it so that it's also the occupant if they are different. So if the property is owned by somebody but occupied by somebody else, they're both going to get written notice. And on the house side, when we went through this, the house wanted to make sure that after the mailing, if that's the chosen method of issuing notice, that there's a 7-day waiting period before they set foot on the property. So with that, maybe Fred has something else to add to this, but I think that in giving the public both the owner and the occupant the ability to know, you don't run into a situation where the owner knows about it and he's absentee, failed to tell the occupant, and the occupant comes out charging with a shotgun. And that doesn't happen very often, thank God, but it could. And I think this is a good bill. And so with that, I would encourage your support of this. Thank you, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Hi, I'm Fred Venata, registered lobbyist for the PLSO. And I'm here to indicate their support for the legislation. I think it's been pretty clearly explained.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anybody else? That's all I have signed up on 2893. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on 2893? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on 2893 and open the work session on 2893.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2893 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill 2893 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there opposition to the motion? House Bill 2893 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Burdick is excused. And let's see. I know, Gerard really likes surveyors. Gerard, would you like to carry another surveyor bill?
Sure.
We got a carrier. Okay, we'll open on House Bill 3457.
Richard. House Bill 3457A allows a performer in a scripted stage, motion picture, or television production to use a lighted smoking instrument that does not contain tobacco in a public place or place of employment under specified circumstances. There is no revenue impact. There is a fiscal statement issued, but no specific request to refer it to Ways and Means.
Okay. We have two people signed up. And this looks like Christina McNutt?
McNutt.
And, oh, there. And Kathy King?
Relating to the smoking instruments and scripted productions.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Christina McNitt, and I am representing this afternoon the Cultural Advocacy Coalition for Arts, Heritage, and Humanities. And I am sorry to say that my main witness, Paul Nicholson, who's the executive director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, is in New York City today, so he wasn't able to join me. But I do have written testimony showing his support for this bill. And I'd also like to thank Tom Haygood from the Portland Center Stage, also in support of this bill, and Dan Murphy with the Broadway Rose Theater. What the bill does, short and sweet, that it allows under the Indoor Clean Air Act a performer to smoke or carry a lighted smoking instrument that does not contain tobacco while performing in a scripted stage, motion picture, or television production if the production is produced by an organization whose primary purpose is producing scripted productions and the smoking is an integral part of the production. Smoking, as you probably have guessed, is often employed in plays to establish a mood, the air of the play, and an overall feeling of the play. And for many years, the Shakespeare Festival used herbal cigarettes and inserted a notice in the playbill saying that some actors in this production smoke herbal cigarettes in compliance with the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act.
However, in 2009, the festival received an interpretation from the current Oregon Clean Air Act from the Multnomah County Health Department that specified smoking of any smoking instrument was not in compliance with the law. And so you'll see through their testimony over the last couple of years, they've tried a variety of alternative cigarettes that really are not that realistic. And so we have worked with DHS and Katie King to develop House Bill 3457 and the language there. Recently, we've learned of a verbal opinion, now an interpretation from the Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Human Services, that smoking instruments only containing tobacco are out of compliance with the Indoor Clean Air Act. But since 2 years ago, we had a different opinion. You can understand why we're interested in seeking some legislation that makes that very clear. Bottom line, I cannot close and be in front of this committee without saying a few things, and that is the Oregon Shakespeare Festival is one of the two largest theaters in the United States. They produce 11 plays each season to an audience of more than 400,000. They reach 120,000 students a year through their educational program, and most important for the business committee here, they employ over 600 people with most salaries exceeding the living wage, and they have an economic impact that exceeds $170 million a year. For those of you in the Portland area, the Portland Center stage serves more than 180,000 people a year, and their 2010-2011 operating budget of $8.7 million helps them employ 70 full-time and 40 part-time staff, plus about 300 actors, designers, directors, and other contract artists throughout the year. The theater's estimated economic impact in the state is $14 million. So thank you for your serious consideration of this bill on behalf of the arts, heritage, and humanities communities.
Thank you, Christine.
Good afternoon, committee. For the record, my name is Katie King, and I'm the Government Relations Manager for the State Public Health Division. And I just want to say, yes, we did work with the Oregon Cultural Advocacy Center, and we came up with some amendments that work for everybody, and they just clarify that actors in scripted performances can't carry products containing tobacco and smoke them on the stage. So we are fine with the amended bill, and please to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Atkinson, did you want to comment?
I have a couple questions.
You have a couple questions?
Yeah. Ms. McNitt, also known as Mick Olson.
In these
performed stories that your clients have on stage, is it true only bad guys smoke?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, I think I have confessed to you in the past that it's a privilege to represent the Cultural Advocacy Coalition, but I really know how to lobby in this building. The sad thing is, really, I'm culturally illiterate. So if I had my prop here, Paul Nicholson could answer that off the top of his head, but I can't. I would suspect that some good people do smoke as well.
As a former employee of the Oregon Shakespearean Festival and guy who used to get hidden in the Angus Bomer Theater coat closet during high school to do homework for my friends who were paid ushers, I would say that good guys do smoke. However, I wonder if you're not setting us up. Second question for Ms. King. Ms. King, the bill states scripted stage. Scripted. Does this prevent a comic who's doing some impromptu from using a smoking device in their act?
Mr. Chair and Senator Atkinson, that's a really good question. In response to your first question to Ms. McNitt, the public health division is here to help people, all good people, to to quit if they wish to. On your second question, I think what we're getting at is what we've seen in other states where there's been some sort of loophole that would allow people to smoke during performances is a lot of bars were staging theater nights and setting up stages, and patrons became actors. So that's the intent of the language here. And I think for a scripted performance, we're talking about plays and other performances where that's an important piece of
defining who a bad guy is. Right. Well, just one comment. This might be a little on the discriminatory side, because without a cigar, George Burns would not have been George Burns. Mm-hmm. It was his prop and his act.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Senator, I would guess that from my knowledge about that most of the comedian's acts, while they appear impromptu, are scripted.
Mm-hmm.
If you think that this committee is scripted...
Well, I definitely know that is not the case. Having tried to chair this committee, I, particularly with my vice chair. Is there any other questions of this very nice panel? Thank you, ladies.
Thanks for your time. Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3457? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3457.
Senator Atkins.
No.
Yeah.
Don't worry, it's just ink.
Mm-hmm.
I would move House Bill 3457 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill 3457 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion?
Does it allow hookahs?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, I would only ask...
Senator Burdick.
I will support this bill, but I would only ask that you not ask me to carry it, because I think if I carried anything allowing anybody to smoke anywhere, I would turn to stone.
Not to worry, Senator Burdick. I know who's carrying this bill. Is there any opposition to this bill? See no opposition. House Bill 3457 is passed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation, with Senator Atkinson carrying this bill. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3457, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2700. And I will note for the audience, I detect there's a whole lot of people who want to talk about this today, so we will do that. It is not the chair's intent to work this bill today. I've had a request by a number of members of the Senate that they wanted a little more time to think about this, one way or the other. So, Richard.
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 2700 includes a removal or fill activity for linear infrastructure maintenance in the types of projects within the Department of State Lands Removal Fill Permitting Program. There's no revenue and no fiscal impact. I also received a -6 amendment with no revenue impact, but I have not yet received a fiscal impact, as well as a -7 amendment that has no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Thank you, Richard. I have about 3 pages of people who wish to testify on this, and so I'm going to ask people to limit their testimony to no more than 2 minutes, so let us know where you're at, and we'll go with that. And I believe we have one person who actually, I know, have sponsored an amendment, a couple here. Ian, I'm going to always say your name, Malosky from the Sierra Club. Is he here?
Ivan
Murkowski? Yeah. And Roger Beyer, I believe you also, do you want to come up with your members separately? Why don't you come on up, start up? Yeah, all 3 of you. Because I think I'm calling you guys because I believe you have offered amendments. So tell us what the amendments are and say whatever you want to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. With me is Jim James from the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, the Executive Director. I will let him speak about the association. I will briefly describe the amendment, and I apologize. I just got this amendment this afternoon, and I haven't had a chance to study it to make sure it does what I think it, or I hope it does, but hopefully it will. It is the Dash B7 amendment, and the idea behind the Dash B7 amendments is that what we have found out is that linear projects that are licensed by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, is my understanding that once they get that licensing from the FERC, they become exempt from Oregon's environmental laws, such as the Forest Practices Act, the Clean Water Act is federal, but there's the Forest Practices Act, there's the Emergency Management Services Act. They don't have to carry any liability insurance for what the projects do off the project, like fire and things like that. So what the Dash 7 amendments does is the attempt is to set up a dual path for these projects. If a facility, applicant wants to go down the having those regulations where they don't have to deal with Oregon's environmental laws, they would be required to stay in the current path, which means they'd have to have the permission of the applicant or the landowners before they can make application. If they want this expedited process where they don't need the permission of the landowners to file the application, they would have to voluntarily agree to, and what I put in this amendment was they would have to agree to follow the Forest Practices Act, the Emergency Management Services, they'd have to carry liability insurance for any fires, and they'd also have to follow any State Department of Agricultural noxious weed rules. There may be other state environmental laws and rules that are that could be included in this amendment, but these are the ones I thought of and included in this amendment. Mr. Chair, I think that's the least we could ask of these companies, that if they're going to build one of these projects and they want to have an expedited process, that they at least have to then follow our environmental laws and rules in order to do that. So that's briefly what the B7s do. I'll turn it over to Jim James, talk very briefly about Oswald and the private property rights issues that the bill also raises.
Thanks, Roger.
Yeah.
Jim?
Chairman Beyer and the rest of the committee, Jim James, Executive Director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. And Oswa, I spoke to this committee before, but just as a reminder, Oswa represents small woodland owners in our state, woodland owners who own less than 5,000 acres. And one of our policies is the protection of private property rights. And it is our opinion that House Bill 2700 does step on private property rights by taking the landowner out of the original application process. And so we would just encourage the committee to give that issue due consideration. Again, we are opposed to that aspect of House Bill 2700.
Thank you.
Chairman Beyer, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. The Farm Bureau in Oregon represents over 7,000 family farmers across the state. I don't want to be repetitive, so I will just say that the Farm Bureau, for similar reasons as Oswa, has concerns with House Bill 2700 regarding the private property rights aspects of the new permitting process that would be implemented after this bill were to be signed into law, if it were to be signed into law.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Chair?
Senator Burdick?
You might not be the right person to say. I was kind of surprised to hear that when FERC approves something that it's exempt from all the laws, and especially that it has no liability. If there is an incident like a fire or something, how is it covered under the existing system? Or do you know?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that someone else may be able to answer that question better than me. It was brought to my attention that a 2005 Natural Gas Act or something like that at the federal level exempted gas pipelines specifically, and I was under the impression that only gas pipelines were exempt, but then I heard from a representative of Portland General Electric that all FERC projects are exempt from the environmental laws of the state. So you'd have to ask them that to make sure that is the case, but that's what I was told. So that's what we're attempting to get at with this amendment, is to try to get those, at least get that part of our laws followed.
I think the chairman knows the answer to that.
I'm curious how they do that.
I might add a little clarity in my understanding of the way the laws work on fires. If someone starts a fire, they're negligent, and they're responsible for all of the costs of putting that fire out, and they would then have to pay the Department of Forestry that expense. But there's no protection for the private landowner whose timber gets burnt and is destroyed. And so he would have to pay for the cost of the fire, but I'm not aware of any provision where they would be liable to pay for all the damage that was done from that fire without a lawsuit.
Jim, is that true of any property owner that causes a fire?
I'm specifically on forest. I guess I'm not.
Yeah, familiar. I understand that. Yeah. But if you had a couple of forests, private forests and federal forests sitting next to each other, and
the
starts on one, hurts somebody else's, what's the liability?
Yeah, if the fire was non-negligent, then the landowner would only be responsible for up to $300,000 worth of payment for the cost of the fire.
And that's the laws that exist today.
But if he's negligent, he's responsible for all the costs.
Okay.
And he could be vulnerable then for a lawsuit to the damaged neighbor.
I'm interested to check with counsel, because I don't know how a FERC permit would exempt anybody from any of that. But that's interesting. I'm curious. It's from a fire hat that I wore. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Ryan, you want to address your amendment, please?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Molesky with the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club. We're here to talk about the Dash 6 Amendment, which I presume you'll have a copy of up there in front of you. This is a very simple amendment. This addresses a big concern that this bill, that a lot of people here in this room have with this bill around liquefied natural gas. And essentially, the Dash 6 Amendment is an attempt to allow for a win-win, a speedier development of municipal projects such as water pipes or roads, renewable energy transmission, rail and roads, while leaving the current rules in place for pipelines that are physically connected to a proposed LNG import or export terminal. It specifically does this by limiting the scope of the changes to the definition of the word applicant in the wetland removal fill program to exclude pipelines that are, again, physically connected to an LNG import or export terminal. Thus, this would allow public bodies such as cities, counties, special districts, and state agencies, as well as some private projects, to move forward and proceed under new streamlined applicant provisions, but would again require those who seek to specifically develop LNG to go through to keep the existing process in place, which we believe protects landowners but also the environment. This is a simple, narrow amendment that would create a win-win where many beneficial projects could move forward, but would prevent the type of situation we're talking about with real-world impacts from LNG pipelines. So I have a larger piece of testimony here that I would love to go into. I just wanted to make sure that you had an understanding of what the Dash 6 Amendment was about.
Have you got it written there?
I do.
How about if you just have we got copies of that?
I'm giving you copies. I'll just give a brief overview if that would be at least helpful.
I'm trying to hold everybody just a couple of minutes.
I understand that.
I've got a lot of people who want to talk.
So essentially, the issue here is that, as you mentioned, in 2005, the Federal Energy Policy Act took away states' rights as it comes to LNG siting specifically. So LNG was put in sort of a new special category under the Federal Energy Policy Act. It used to be that LNG was cited to the Oregon Energy Facility Siting Council, in which you had state agencies helping determine whether projects were needed, whether they were in the public interest, and whether they met all of our environmental laws. That was, again, taken away. And at this point, what it's created is a very chaotic process that is driven by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which has allowed us to be in a situation where there are three competing and duplicative LNG proposals all coming in at one time, which has created a lot of stress for farmers and forest landowners throughout western Oregon, and a lot of potential threats to salmon-bearing rivers, late successional forests, high-value farmland, and whatnot. So without going into the deeper bones of that, because of its implications for LNG development, the Oregon Conservation Network has declared House Bill 2700B a major threat. It's opposed by major conservation groups like the Sierra Club and the Columbia River Keeper, and again, if we could amend it along the lines of the Dash 6, and frankly, the Dash 7 looks like a good amendment to us, but it doesn't address our core concerns. So if it could be amended along the lines of the Dash 6, I think you'd see a lot of groups that have been opposed to this bill willing to support it so we could have that win-win. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Ivan?
Quick question.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ivan, what
What's your interpretation of physically connected? It says physically connected to a liquefied natural gas terminal. It's my understanding, and I'm not an expert in this area, but it's my understanding that these natural gas pipelines are sort of a network. And so I'm wondering if, I mean, you have a clear intent here, but is that going to affect other pipelines in the network or that might be hooked up to the network?
Chair Beyer, Senator Edwards, it's a good question. I think you're correct. Our intent is to limit the scope of this to just those that are directly physically connected to an LNG import or export terminal. We have recently heard this concern, and so if we had time, if there was time, there might be a couple of words we might change in this amendment to clarify that, if that would be helpful. One is you could, for instance, cut out the word system, because that may create some of the confusion there, so that we're, again, trying to just deal with those specific pipelines that are physically connected to those proposed terminals that we're talking about. There have been three proposed in Oregon recently. One is the Pacific Connector Pipeline, about 230-mile line that would be physically connected from the Jordan Cove terminal in Coos Bay down to Mullen. There's the Palomar Pipeline, what had been proposed would be physically connected from the Bradwood Landing Terminal to the Trans-Canada North-South line, and there's an Oregon LNG 100-mile line as well. So that's what our intent is, to get at those. The other piece is you could say, for instance, physically connected to a liquefied natural gas terminal located in Oregon, intended to import or export. So that way, hopefully, that could avoid any concern over whether we're inadvertently dealing with gas that may already be coming in from Canada on existing lines.
So I just want to make sure that I understand, Ivan, your concern. So if you were the Palomar pipeline that would connect the Northwest Pipeline down the valley with the Trans-Canada going up out of roughly Malawa over to the Eastern Oregon, you wouldn't be opposed to that? That's not a concern?
I will tell you, Senator Chair Beyer, that the Sierra Club has a lot of concerns about the eastern section of Palomar because of its impacts to the Mount Hood National Forest. I will say that this amendment is likely would not cover that, because it's specifically about import or export. So if Northwest Natural were to ever bring back the Palomar East section, which specifically only crosses the Cascades and goes to Malala, not to the coast, it would not actually likely not be covered by this amendment. It's frankly, but I won't say that means that we support that section of the pipeline. And if that comes up in future rulemaking or public processes, we're definitely reserve our right to raise concerns over the specific impacts on that.
So you have similar concerns about the electrical transmission lines that were coming over the mountains and would do the same kind of corridor?
Chair Beyer, our concerns around the power lines really are limited to, we just want to make sure they use existing utility corridors across Mount Hood. There's one, as I'm sure you're aware, there are a couple different alternatives for the power lines that we're talking about. One would cut through new ground, which would be the same route of the Palomar East. Another proposal would go on existing transmission corridors. We would favor a route that would simply go along an existing transmission corridor. That would be our ideal situation. And I will say this too, Chair Beyer, that though the rules have clearly helped landowners be protected from LNG imports, the rules also have not strictly prohibited development of linear utilities in the state. For instance, the Ruby Pipeline, which transports gas from Wyoming to southeastern Oregon, has moved forward. There were a lot of people working on that down near Lakeview this past summer, and that's an example of when you have local support for a project, these types of issues around wetland removal fill don't come up in the same way that they have with these other pipelines on LNG that have been very contentious locally, and it feels like people are being, frankly, pushed around by out-of-state LNG companies. So the Ruby Pipeline is an example that has brought new gas into the region that didn't face the same sorts of obstacles, either due to these wetland removal fill rules or, frankly, the environmental concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thanks, Ivan. Louise Soliday. Well, how did you get us into this mess, Louise?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. It was the 2001 legislature who got us into this mess, I think.
I'm pretty sure it was 2003.
Oh, it may have been.
Because I wasn't here when they did that.
Okay. Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. Senate or House Bill 2700B would do a couple of things, and I want to talk about what this bill does not do. It does not expedite a process. It doesn't change any of the timelines by which we process our permits. It doesn't change any of the timelines that DLCD would use for their coastal zone certification. It doesn't change any timelines for the 401 permit that DEQ has to issue. It doesn't change any of the timelines, not that there really are timelines for the 404 permit or ESA consultation. So it doesn't change any of the timelines for processing any of the permits. What the bill does do is expands the definition of applicant to include applicants for linear projects. It also puts in statute something we already do in rule, and that is a requirement of notification to folks along the pipeline and landowners adjacent to the pipeline so that they're aware and they can participate in the public review process, which we go through with our all of our applications. The bill also requires that before construction begin on any permitted project, that the project applicant must be in control of the property either through ownership or through permission from the landowner.
Is that new?
Mr. Chair, that is something we used to require prior to the change in law as a permit condition. So this would, it's not an issue under the current statute. If the statute is changed, it would become an issue again, and we would go back to permitting all of our, conditioning all of our permits with that requirement that construction could not begin until they were, have a ownership interest or have permission of the landowners. The bill would only apply to permits that are applied for after the effective date of the bill.
Can you address, we're using the terminology linear, what's included under that as a linear project?
So under the bill, if you look at section section 1 on page 3, lines 32 through 34, it would add that linear facility, and then if you go to page 4 at the top, it would define linear facility as a railway, highway, road, pipeline, water or sewer line, communication line, overhead or underground electrical transmission or distribution line, or similar facility. So we're talking about a broad range of linear projects from roads, water lines, sewer lines, utility lines, so very broadly.
So are there problems that DSLs currently or applicants are currently encountering with the laws that's written today?
Mr. Chair, under the current definition of applicant, you must be the landowner or have the permission of the landowner in order to be an applicant. And so currently we cannot accept applications from anyone other than the landowner or someone who has the permission of the landowner.
Okay, go ahead.
What this bill does do is allow these projects to get in the door to apply for a permit and start the process and go through the process. It changes the timing of when they come in the door. The proponents of these projects, in many cases, are public entities who already have the power of eminent domain under Oregon law or will get or already have a FERC certificate that comes with the power of eminent domain as well. The project's proponents have a couple of options in terms of eminent domain. And my experience with the folks who do these projects, the last thing they want to do is have to condemn property. They try to work voluntarily with landowners to come to agreement on some access easement, whatever the case may be, outright purchase of the property to do the projects. Under the current situation, in order for these applicants to come in the door, they would have to exercise their power of eminent domain where they have I won't say unwilling landowners, they're unable to reach agreement with landowners along the route. They would go through that process, condemn the property, and then they could come in and apply for a permit with us. For us, that means they've made some sort of decision about where the pipeline route or road or water line or sewer line, whatever the case may be, is going to be. And as we review those in our process, we're reviewing them for impacts to waters of the state. And we would require mitigation for the impacts to waters of the state, which is fairly broadly defined. So we may look at a project and say, well, if you had moved the road, water line, sewer line, whatever it is, over here, you could have avoided a wetland, a stream, whatever the case may be, and reduced the impacts to waters of the state, which may put some of these companies in a position where they, or public entities, where they may have condemned property that they no longer need for the project. So,
whoops, bought the wrong property, huh?
Exactly. And so this would allow them to come in, make application. We issue a permit or not, depending on whether they get through our process. And for those permits that are issued, they then know what the pipeline route is that we've approved as under our permit, and they can make those contacts to landowners, work through the process, and hopefully reach agreement with those landowners voluntarily. And if not, then exercise the power of eminent domain that comes either because they're a public entity or they've got a FERC certification.
Louise, do you believe that the bill that's proposed in front of us in any way changes the environmental review criteria that changes the way that decisions are made by your agency?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it doesn't change any of the statutory provisions or rule provisions that lay out the criteria by which we review these projects, so there would be no change in that.
So, essentially, you believe you'd get to the same decision either way?
This is a timing issue of when do they come in the door.
Senator Starr?
Thank you. Ms. Holliday, do you have any opinion on any of the DASH amendments? Have you had a chance to review any of those?
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, I just saw the DASH 6 amendments when somebody mentioned that there was one. As I understand it, that the B6 would create two different tracks, one for those pipelines that connect to a terminal, import or export terminal, who would still go through the process we are using currently. So they could not come in the door until after they've gotten control of the land or used the power of eminent domain. So it would set up a dual track. Some linear projects could come in earlier. The others would have to wait. So that's what the A6 amendment would do. It would put us in a position of how to make a determination of which goes in which direction. The B7 amendment, I've looked at it. I listened to Roger Beyer and the other folks who testified. I think there might be a different way to get at the issue that they're trying to get at. The way this is written, it would apply to anybody who's applying for a linear project. And I'm not sure that what I heard them say was they want it to apply to the FERC licensed projects. Water and sewer lines don't go through that process. I'm not sure these are applicable to that. So I think there's a different way to get at the issue that I heard them say they were trying to get at with this amendment. And so.
Thank you, Mr.
Anyone else? Thank you, Louise.
Sure.
All right, I have, as far as I can tell here, four people who have said they've traveled more than 100 miles, so I'm going to take them first. Bob Barker, I believe. Bill Grow. And Jody McCaffrey. And then after that, Monica Vaughn. So again, I would ask you to try to keep your comments to 2 minutes. We've got about 16 minutes or so here. So,
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Bob Barker. I'm an affected landowner along the Pacific Connector gas pipeline route, the 234-mile line from proposed from Coos Bay to Malin. I'm here, first of all, to advocate for the Dash B amendment. I have not heard of the specifics of the Dash 7 amendment before today, but from what I've heard, it sounds like something that we should work to incorporate into this legislation. One thing I would like to say specifically, the existing legislation that passed the House does not, in the case where the applicant is not a landowner or the person who is authorized by the landowner files the permit, the B amendment, the existing bill gives the applicant, other than the landowner, the right to appeal, but does not give that same right to the landowner. Seems to me the landowner must have the same right to appeal the decision by DSL, either approving the permit or denying the permit. That seems only fair. After all, landowners must have some rights in this process. Please. One thing that has not been discussed here and that's also different about these LNG projects is I think most of these local projects we're talking about, we have a very clear demonstration of need. Okay, on these LNG projects, the question of need for the citizens of Oregon is very, very questionable. Okay, first of all, we have plenty of domestic supply that can be brought in by the Ruby Line. We do not need foreign LNG. California has refused to approve these types of terminals, so the companies have come to Oregon to try and backdoor gas to California. We have the possibility that these lines will eventually be used for export because of the economics, because the worldwide market prices are so much higher than our adequate domestic supply of gas, which could result in higher gas prices for all of us. So these are some reasons why we're looking at a different scenario and why the B amendment makes sense to have a different treatment. Another point is that in the case of the Pacific Connector gas pipeline, they asked landowners along the route, some 400 of us, for our consent to file the permit. A large number of us declined to do so. No further attempt was ever made by Pacific Connector to negotiate with landowners in an attempt to obtain their consent. And this seems like an only fair and proper thing to do. Instead, they're just going and trying to change the law so that it's not necessary to do this. I would also point out, you may not be aware that the Pacific Gas Connector pipeline filed suit against the state of Oregon claiming that the current law is unconstitutional. That has currently been put on hold until the end of the legislative session because, of course, the hope is that you will pass this bill in its current form and the issue will become moot. If this current process is not constitutional, let's let the legal process run its course and let's decide it that way. From a personal standpoint, these lines have a huge impact on property owners along the line. In my case, one-third of my property will be clear-cut, leveled for both the construction of the line and a 3,000-foot drill underneath the Rogue River has a huge impact on our property. My neighbor next to me has a small parcel that he had hoped eventually to build a home on. He will not be able to do so. The landowner on the other side does not want to live near a high-pressure gas pipeline. And is trying to sell his property, and as you might well imagine, he's having no success in selling his property. So there are real impacts to individuals for projects that are not needed. So I hope that you will approve the Dash 6 Amendment, and thank you for consideration.
Thank you.
My name is Jody McCaffrey. I'm the Executive Director of Citizens Against LNG. I'm representing over 4,000 citizens that have signed a petition that oppose the project in the Jordan Cove facility. I have a lot of issues with this that may be not totally related to the LNG. Whenever you're taking some is whenever you're taking landowners' rights out of the equation, you're basically giving the right that actually a foreign corporation could take a permit out on people's property. You need to put a lot of protections in there. And this bill, I feel the way, once you took it out, you didn't put those protections in there. This is so big you could drive a truck through it. For instance, you're saying you're going to notify landowners, but there's no certified mail. It's just you could send a mail. They may never get it. That doesn't give them the right to have a process. Recently, we just had a process with the Land Use Board of Appeals of Oregon on the same issue of landowner signature, because what these facilities are trying to do is bypass a landowner signature. And LUBA ruled, no, you cannot do that. You either have to have a signature or you have to give an automatic hearing. That's only fair to landowners. This doesn't even allow the hearing until after the decision is made by the Department of State Lands. So that's not fair to landowners right there. There's no protection. Here's the other issue. It does have some rights where landowners, you're saying that they can take the permit out, but they don't have a right to go on the land unless landowners approve it. Once they get the permit, all it is a legal. They can go to a judge once they have the permit in hand. That judge is going to automatically rule against the landowner. It's not fair to landowners. These companies have huge dollars, and the poor little landowner has nothing to fight them. He doesn't have the resources. It's really not fair process. You're basically supposed to be representing people here, the people of the state of Oregon, not necessarily the large corporations. And in this case, in the Jordan Cove proposal, it's a foreign corporation. I can't even believe we're even debating this issue, because we are saying it's okay for a foreign corporation to take a permit out on American landowners. That's just wrong. I don't care how you put it. The issue that why they're arguing that they need this, okay, is because they don't want to have to eminent domain property and then find out later from the Department of State Lands that they couldn't go that way, they should go over here. There's some flaws with that, I see, in two reasonings. This could be written just for soil sampling. It's not. It's a full. It doesn't distinguish whether they're going to remove 5.6 million cubic yards of material or just going to do soil sampling. With the way they do mapping, if you look at the mapping, there is no excuse for them not knowing where they are aerial photographing these. They can go right down to the leaf and see what's there. So they know what's there. This is just to fast track this process so they can bypass the landowner, take away landowner rights so they don't have the right to appeal or object to some of this. So that's basically what this boils down to. It speeds up the process for them, makes it more difficult. It does give the director of the Department of State Lands a lot of authority, but it really takes away the authority of landowners. That just is absolutely not fair. Now, we don't have a problem, okay, if it's a public project, a public municipality that needs a publicly funded project. We don't have a problem with that. We see the need for that to be maybe speeded up. But this, in these cases with the liquefied natural gas pipelines, this is not the case. FERC did issue, in the case of the Jordan Cove LNG facility, a certificate of public convenience and necessity. And so they're going ahead with these other permits, but that is under, we have done a request for rehealing. That's going to be ended up in the courts. We're going to win on that. And meanwhile, they've gone and gotten all these permits and put the state through a lot of process that should have been stopped until the federal case was absolutely cleared up. That cost us, it cost our agency people time. They shouldn't even have to be looking at this until that certificate is cleared. And this does not put anything in this bill that specifies that. I would like to say one other thing about the fact about the fire issue. If it's an act of terror, that is considered an act of war, and insurance companies do not cover any of that. So you're basically out of luck. I don't know if I've missed anything. We just should not allow private and foreign corporations this right over American.
Thank you. Sir?
My name is Bill Gall. I'm a rancher down in Roseburg, Oregon, a first-generation rancher. This pipeline will come through my ranch for a couple miles. This affects me big time. I don't know what you guys live, how you live, or whatever, but this is a major, major impact on my ranch. Okay? I just can't even believe I have to even be here to talk about something as crazy as this. I'm a private property owner. I work my ass off to buy this property, to put it together,
And now I got a private company that won't even negotiate with me, that wants to do an end around on me to get around negotiating with me. I wish you guys would give me the hammer that you want to give them. I can't even believe I'm even here. That I own a ranch, they're going to put this thing through with me, and now that I won't give them permission to do it, they're going to go to you guys to get you guys to give them permission. It's just beyond me that we're even here having this discussion. This is America. And I can't even imagine that you guys want to give them permission to go on my property like I would give them permission to go in your house. You know, I mean, this isn't like this is just some little bunch of land. I bought this land. I worked for it. And that's where I live. That's where my family, my grandkids, everybody's going to be raised right on that ranch. And I can't imagine you guys going to let them come in and screw my ranch up. I just can't even imagine it. And why I don't even have the say. Like I told them right from the start, if you want this ranch, buy it. Well, we can't afford to do that. Well, I can't afford to have you messing my ranch up. I just can't even imagine you guys, if you own anything, would even vote for this. It's really emotional for me, and I'm sorry I get so excited about it, but this is going to screw my whole life up that I worked my whole life up, and I can't believe that however many of you are going to vote on this might let this go through. This is crazy. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you very much. Monica Vaughn.
You should hear him talking to environmentalists.
Ludwig Hitz, and let's see, Dan, I'm not sure, Sir?
Sayers.
Hmm?
Sayers. Hi, thank you for taking public testimony. My name is Monica Vaughn, and I've been working with impacted landowners across the state for the last 3 years. To me, it seems only fair that if you want to apply for a permit on a private property, that you should have to get landowner permission to get that permit. I'd like to address Director Soliday's interpretation of the condition of construction. I've heard some staff members from the Senate saying that the conditions that are represented from line 12 to 20, giving the conditions that are required for construction, protects landowners and gives them the say for whether or not construction happens. I'd like to point out that at the end of there's three conditions, A, B, and C, and at the end of line B, there is an or and not an and. The three conditions are if the company has control over the land, not if they are a landowner. So if they have a court judgment on the property, then they can do the construction without landowner permission. Now, the company already has the FERC certificate, and that gives them the right to eminent domain. So I'd just like to point out those lines 12 to 20, in this case of pipelines related to LNG terminals, are almost irrelevant because landowners will not have any additional power granted by those additional lines in this event, in this proposed bill 2700. The way that state law is written right now, Oregon state law is written to allow landowners to participate in the process for an application on their private property. This is the only point in the permitting process of liquefied natural gas infrastructure on federal and state level in which landowners have a say about what is going to happen to their property. Oregon state law gives them the only say that landowners have over this process. And I think that we need to protect that. With this amendment that we're asking for, -7, -6, we said -B, exempting pipelines related to liquefied natural gas terminals, we're not asking for special treatment for these projects. What we're asking for is for them to follow through on current state law that every single other pipeline that has been built in this state has successfully negotiated, including the Ruby pipeline. They worked with landowners in order to get that pipeline permitted, and they are under construction right now. And I don't see any reason why another pipeline company shouldn't have to go through the same process. I want to vote for protection of landowner rights. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Ludwig Hitz. I'm a concerned Oregonian and concerned landowner. And not to bore you with anything, but I think the people before me, the four people that testified just now, have eloquently put forth, probably better than I could put forth, California turned down terminals, I think, 5 or 6 times. Mexico turned the terminals down after allowing one in. The East Coast has turned these terminals down because of hazards and devaluation of property, which it would do for my property and hundreds of other landowners in this state. I think it's mute. I mean, we should not have this thing in here. We don't need it. They haven't proved the need for it, and we don't need it. We're getting lots of gas from Canada and the East. And anyway, I want to add one thing. If this law doesn't change anything, as one of the testimonies said, but it does do this. Now, doesn't that change? I mean, or why do they need this bill if it doesn't change anything? You know, I mean, get LNG off of this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and members of the committee. My name is Dan Sears. I'm here representing Columbia Riverkeeper. For 5 or 6 years, we've been working with people all over Oregon who normally would not work with us, who obviously detest the idea of having their land taken for an LNG terminal and associated with pipeline. This amendment, the Dash 6 amendment, is very narrow. It's tailored to do one thing and one thing only. It's to grab LNG and take it out of the bill, because people in this room are willing, essentially, to concede everything else and to say LNG is the biggest monster that would be benefited by this. And the reason, you know, is that there's literally thousands of Oregonians, like Bill, like Lud, like others who are going to speak in this room, who are impacted by this directly. Thousands. There are at least 1,800 landowners that I can count, you know. And then there are their families. And so the amendment is very narrow, and it would not, for instance, Chair Beyer, you raised the question of whether it would affect Palomar East. It would not, because it frankly just got too complicated, and we wanted to make it very clear that we're talking about pipelines that are directly dependent and physically connected to liquefied natural gas terminals, and that's two pipelines. That's the Oregon LNG pipeline and the Pacific Connector pipeline. That's it. That's where we stand right now, and so any questions you have about that? I think that the amendment is, as Ivan suggested, there are changes that could be made that could fix any problems you have. Ultimately, you know, from our perspective, unless this bill is amended, you know, if it passes, it is absolutely a vote in favor of LNG, and that's the problem that thousands of Oregonians, that's the predicament people are being put in. And in 2008, this bill was originally suggested by Bradwood LNG. So we strongly encourage you to adopt the Dash 6 amendment, and thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. Let's see, there's a whole bunch of people who are here every day, and I'm just going to try not to call on them. I'm going to call on the people who aren't here every day, the real people, if you will. So,
Mr.
Yes.
Just a comment, and I apologize. I'm going to have to step out here in a moment and get to another meeting, but the last two panels in my mind are in conflict. The landowner, our rancher from Douglas County, correct me if I'm wrong, but if this were amended to just remove LNG, you still have the same concerns with the permitting process, do you not?
No, for me, they're not going to put a water line through my rancher. Not telling me that LNG is going to go through there, so I just can't believe that this unlevels the playing field. You got a private company negotiate with a private landowner.
I realize, but I don't. We not to cut you off. But there's a protocol rules here. If it's simply around LNG, I mean, to me, there's two different things. There's LNG, and then there's the permitting process. But it to me doesn't seem synonymous. If you remove LNG, are you removing every kind of other issue on the land? And the answer is no.
Rather than open the debate, I want to give people a chance to come in.
Mr. Chair, I just also, I'm supposed to be at a meeting that started at 5 o'clock, so I'm going to have to slip out. Yeah. But I appreciate the folks being here to testify and look forward to reading the
report. Somebody answer the question, though, about this problem that you're having between LNG and the other lines. I mean, we don't put power lines across ranches willy-nilly. the other lines that you're talking about, these small pipelines that go along roads, LNG is a bulldozed piece of land 120 feet wide across vineyards, woods, streams, rivers, ranches, wetlands, everything. It's not a narrow pipeline.
Do I have your name here? Would you like to testify?
My name is Kay Peterson.
Okay, Kay.
I live in Woodburn.
And how about Paul Dryden and Lolita Carl?
And I'd like to say that Paul Dryden had to take time off from work, and it's very rare that he can get time off from work to come here.
I'm glad we can let him speak then.
And what is, you know, you can do one of two things, in my opinion, is just take the entire amendment, I mean this entire House bill, off the table completely, because a lot of this was written by LNG a number of years ago in different configurations. Or you can go ahead with amendment that just clearly says that liquefied natural gas pipelines cannot get this fast track kind of permitting process without the landowner's permission. I mean, I don't object to the city of Milwaukee wanting to get permits quickly for a dangerous sidewalk. And the last time I was here, that's a lot of the testimony that I heard was about issues like this. This is not why we're here. We're here because we have farms or vineyards, ranches that would be heavily impacted. You can't put a fence post. You can only grow perennial crops in the area that they have an easement on. And the other thing is that FERC has never turned down an application. You don't have to demonstrate a need for liquefied natural gas. They allow, you know, they just issued permits for everything. Dan, have they ever turned down FERC? Once. All right, I apologize. One time has FERC turned down a request for a permit in the whole United States. So for you to think that just because FERC approved this does not mean that a need was demonstrated.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Atkinson, committee that's left. Paul Dryden.
Thank you.
I'm a concerned and affected landowner south of Woodburn. Once again, we are faced with the manipulative and aggressive annex of out-of-state energy speculators. House Bill 2700 would make it easier for LNG companies to acquire wetland removal fill permits and to do unneeded projects on private property without landowner consent. Deleting or altering the current definition of applicant seriously undermines our rights as private property owners. When considering the definition of linear facilities, we ask that you amend House Bill 2700 to exclude privately owned profit-seeking LNG companies. The LNG projects would damage and destroy our waterways, forests, and productive farmland, all of which contribute significantly to the economy of Oregon. Oregon does not need LNG. Furthermore, the potential exists for LNG terminals to become export facilities, thereby increasing the cost of natural gas to our citizens as they compete with prices on a global market. We own a 60-acre farm south of Woodburn. Our family has lived on this farm for over 50 years. It is excellent, productive farmland and provides a livelihood for us. We are one of many, many families in this state who have experienced the stress of 4 years of dealing with the LNG industry and their vision of attaining huge profits at our expense. We ask that you will advocate for our rights as property owners and citizens of this state when deciding on this bill.
Thank you very much.
And I just want to ask all you guys, you know, put yourself in our shoes. Think about it. Really think about it. Don't just blow us off.
Thank you. Madam.
Lolita Carl, 13324 Carl Road, Hubbard, Oregon. I'm a full-time farmer operating the farm that has been in our family 96 years. House Bill 2700 is the taking of landowners' rights, opening up fill and removal permits to out-of-state investors, private corporations, or whomever. It means my private property rights can be transferred to another private party without my permission. It is not limited to a public utility. It throws the door wide open, and I am deeply concerned that my legislature would harm its landowning constituents in this way. Thousands of Oregon farmers and woodlot owners are at the risk of losing their livelihood if an LNG-related pipeline crosses their property. A pipeline is scheduled to go through the middle of our farm, and we are told we cannot increase the size of our adjacent hazelnut orchard, put in fence posts for livestock, or posts for a berry patch, or any of the many, many crop changes we have undergone to continue a viable, self-supporting farm for almost a century. In my county, Marion County, agriculture is our number one industry, producing $500 million in farm products annually. Statewide, agriculture is our huge economic contributor to our economy. No one seems to have measured the job and economic loss to this renewable resource called agriculture if farmers' rights are compromised. Please vote no on House Bill 2700. If you do vote yes, please exclude LNG-related pipelines. But I would prefer no. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see. I can't make out the first name. Last name is Wick.
Wick.
W-I-C-K. Wick. Yeah.
Steve.
Okay. And let's see here. So Ivan Vestica. Okay. And is there anybody else on? I'm trying to figure. Go ahead, sir. Go ahead.
Honorable Chair and Vice Chair and members, senators that are left, I would really like to take 2700 and dump it. But I'm a property owner that's faced with two LNG pipelines running through my property, and I'd be really happy if the Dash 6 amendment was passed and the Dash 7 so it protects my forests. Basically, what I'm afraid of is that this House Bill 2700, as it is written, allows somebody to come in and fast-track an LNG pipeline through my property. If you want to fast-track a power line, water line, something that's for the benefit of the people of Oregon, I can understand that. We want the Dash 6 amendment added so it doesn't allow somebody to fast-track unneeded LNG. The Dash 7 amendment would protect my forests. Like I said, I've got two of these pipelines scheduled to come through my property, and they'll come through the wetlands on the bottom of my property. What this does, it gives them the right to put a lien on my property that I can't challenge. There's no end gate. There's no end date on these liens. They can put this lien on, and then they can start fast-tracking a process. And as we already heard, the Ruby Pipeline in Southern Oregon was built using the existing law as it is right now. So we can do that. We can build gas pipelines using existing laws, but what we really, really like is that Dash 6 amendment on there. So LNG pipelines are excluded because the Energy Act of 2005 gave them almost absolute control of our property, and the state of Oregon doesn't have that control. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
I'm looking up here at the group, and I see that you're almost down to losing some people to do the voting. So I guess you'll have to bear with me. I'm Ivan Vistica from the Woodburn area. And I strongly urge you to vote no on this House Bill 2700B. Putting folks to work sounds good. However, this bill does not do that. And I agree with the lady from, I believe she was from the Department of State Lands, that gives them some trouble that they try to solve with the way this amendments that were put in this bill. Incidentally, this bill started out with just talking about the applicant. It went through two of your amendments, and when I saw this last amendment in the black print, I was amazed at how somebody's got the nerve to put something through like that. The existing law has been the good work of previous Oregon legislatures, and I hope you folks continue that program. The bill negatively affects landowners all across Oregon and hereafter, now and hereafter. Passing this latest version of the bill lets a company apply for and receive removal fill permits to cross wetland and streams on our land without first getting landowner input and consent. This is not right. Once the company has a permit from the Department of State Lands, we, the landowner, will be in a subordinate and weak position to then negotiate a reasonable, fair agreement, including the specifications beneficial to the land and a just compensation for this taking. Plus, the company can, and most likely will, intimidate us by implying or strongly indicate the use of a court order or a judgment authorizing the use of the property. To me, this whole scheme sure takes on the look of eminent domain for private companies' use. So, the landowner's input needs to be in the hands of a company at the time of its application to the state lands office. How else can the state lands office consider all the elements of the permitting process? This farm has been facing a proposed 36-inch natural gas pipeline destined to cross the wetlands under the Pudding River. This pipeline will require the displacement of removal of a minimum of 850 cubic yards of earth. That is 85 10-yard truckloads that has to go someplace on this farm, not to the state like the water. I urge a no vote on this bill. Our legislative members out to stick up for Oregon landowners' property rights ahead of favoring companies for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ivan. Let's see, I have Ted Kyle. Is there anybody else who's signed up who isn't around here every day, or most every day? Come on up. Your name, sir?
Good afternoon. I'm Ted Kyle. Thank you, Chair Beyer and members. I'm the city engineer for the city of Tigard. And these permits that we need to get affect nearly a third of the projects that I handle each year. And we're not talking about big jobs, we're talking about some little ones. But for us, we have one large project that we're working in conjunction with the city of Lake Oswego. This is a large project to bring water to nearly 90,000 people. It involves crossing the Willamette River and going underneath Lake Oswego. A tricky proposition. What this bill would do on that job would help us to be able to bring the state in the Division of State Lands into our decision process, so that instead of bringing just one alternative forward and saying, will you give us a permit after we bought the land, after we've ended up getting all the right-of-way to get this job done, and then they say no, is very difficult for us. today we're looking at 9 different routes, each of which have different environmental impacts on the river. It would be nice to have a process to where we could work with landowners and the state concurrently so we can find the one that works for everybody. The way the system works today is we have to pick one, get the property owners to all agree, and then come forward, and that may not be the one that works best for the state or works best for protecting our rivers and streams. But that's not all. I'm working on a project that would widen a road and put in a sidewalk so kids could get to a middle school. It's going to require extending a culvert a little ways for a stream that's not wider than the chairs you're sitting in. But yet, we still have to go through the same process. We still have to determine, the best we can, what the requirements are going to be. The Corps and DSL permits are among the most complex and technical permits that we apply for, as they should be. The catch is now we have to guess at what land we're going to need. We're going to have to get that all lined up before we can come in. And then if we guess wrong, we've tied up property that is not necessary for us to tie up. Another project I worked on was to provide sewer service in a portion of Clackamas County. It took us 8 months to get a permit to make a crossing across a creek, only one necessary for this entire project. Only took us 8 hours to build it, and no fish were harmed in the process. So putting the sequence right such that we can be working with the state to make the best environmental choices, then let us work with the property owners to work out the right-of-way issues and the property rights issues so that we can provide the services we need for our day-to-day projects. I've talked about this particular bill with a number of my colleagues as city engineers throughout Washington County. They all say this would be a huge benefit to how they administer projects in their communities. I've talked about it with also my colleagues throughout the state, and a number of them also see a huge benefit to be able to work with property owners and with the state concurrently rather than sequentially as we're required to do today. So I really recommend it, particularly for municipal projects and for our day-to-day work. This would really make the process work better. It would allow us to design the best project, protect the environment the best we can, involve the state in that project. Their expertise within the state is very good, and we think that this is a good way to get a better project for Oregon and ultimately work with property owners. So I'm in support of the bill, and I would hope that you can pass it to the floor and it will become law.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Chairman Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Paul Riggs. I'm Executive Secretary Treasurer of Columbia Pacific Building Construction Trades Council. We serve the greater Portland area. We have 15,000 members represented by our affiliates. Roughly 30% of those are employed. We support this bill as an infrastructure bill. The ability to use what is becoming a cheaper and cheaper fuel, and it's a cleaner fuel, and utilize it for power plants, manufacturing, whatever other productions you can make with it, is a benefit to the base economy of Oregon. If they're well designed, well installed and maintained, they're safe. The fuel is safe, and the benefits go across the board for the economy. For that reason, we'd ask that this bill be allowed to go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Ma'am?
Good afternoon. My name is Cherry Harris. I'm with the Operating Engineers, Local 701. I'm testifying in support today of House Bill 2700B. What's at stake here really for us is quite simple. This is about quality jobs for Oregonians during the largest economic downturn this state has experienced in decades. The Operating Engineers, Local 701, represents approximately 4,200 members. We are not members of the building trades that Paul Riggs was representing. We have members throughout the state of Oregon and 5.5 counties in southwest Washington. Our folks are skilled heavy equipment operators and crane operators. Our bread and butter is major infrastructure. That includes pipelines of all kinds, that includes power line, that includes windmills, that includes highways, bridges, you name it. So all of these projects, the linear projects, we're affected by. Our membership was and continues to be severely impacted by the economic collapse of 2008, which resulted in 31% reduction in total construction hours worked by our members and a sustained unemployment rate of 38%. We're still sitting at 38% unemployment in our membership. Passage of HB 2700B will level the playing field with the other 49 states in this country. It's vital for our union and all Oregonians if we're, one, to put people back to work, and also to make sure that we have skilled workers here when the economy does turn around, because the longer this recession goes on, the longer our folks don't have work, we're going to lose them. And not have them here when we need them. According to a recent study done by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Oregon has missed out on over 21,000 jobs due to 9 stalled or canceled energy projects, costing the state $6.8 billion. These projects died in large part as a direct result of the permitting challenges that we're facing right now that we're trying to fix with this HB 2700. Those figures are just based upon the energy projects that did not happen, that have not happened. Some of them are dead in the water. Others, maybe they'll come around someday, but they've been in the process for several years, most of them, and they're not happening because of this issue. It's time to pave the way for jobs and economic growth in Oregon. It's vital for our state revenue as we're trying to fund schools. We have less and less people working, no money to do it with. One of the priorities for this legislative session was jobs. This is one of the few jobs bills that is still alive and exists. It's time to pass it. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see, is there anybody else who isn't here most of the time who needs to testify today? Sir?
Thank you, Chairman Beyer and committee members. My name is Tom Bowman. I'm the business rep for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. We have 1,160 members in my local, and even with unemployment, with work getting better, we're still at 22% unemployment. This is a jobs bill. This is going to put people back to work, building an infrastructure that we lack in this state. Matter of fact, we lack it throughout this country. Every other country is gradually building their infrastructure, and we're still running on a 1920s infrastructure here. And as the lady ahead of me said, these jobs which haven't gotten done cost 21,000 jobs. That's not including all the businesses that could come here that when they have to site someplace, they look at Oregon and they say, well, the state doesn't have the transmission lines and infrastructure that another state does. So if we want businesses to come and site in this state and build up a tax base for us, we need to go forward on this jobs bill. That's all I really have to say.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Senator Beyer, Senator Atkinson, member of the committee. My name is Ron Murray. I represent the United Association of Plumbers and Steamfitters. I believe House Bill 2700B is a common sense bill that allows a collaborative effort, as we've heard today, for government to work with industry, not to railroad a project through, but to allow people to make the best decision for the route for a linear project to continue. You've already heard people say it's a jobs bill, and I'm going to say it too. I represent over 4,500 members in the state of Oregon. I have 35% unemployment. Many of my members have been unemployed for over 2 years. They suffered through a 5-year apprenticeship program, just like I did, to be a highly skilled worker in the state of Oregon, and the jobs aren't here to sustain their skills. So what are they going to do? They're going to leave. And that's the facts of life. And when Oregon needs plumbers and steam fitters to build the infrastructure, they won't be here because they're going to states like Michigan, where there are jobs. This bill, I didn't come here to testify on an LNG bill. I came here to testify on a bill that we felt was good government. And part of that bill is it doesn't weaken or erode land use laws. It does not strip away or weaken the rights of property owners, and it certainly doesn't change the current eminent domain process. I live in a place in Oregon called Sauvie Island, and under our property goes, guess what? Gas lines. And on my route down here, driving down the freeway, I passed two, or drove over two. You don't even know they're there. As I said, I didn't come here to testify on LNG. I came here to testify on what I think is a good government bill, and I hope you'll give it consideration. So thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else?
Thank you for allowing me to speak at the last minute. I'm Barbara Wilson, and I live in Beaverton. The unemployment problem in Oregon is very vast, and I soundly doubt that this bill would help that much. Please make a distinction between public projects that will benefit Oregonians and a private enterprise, LNG, where the profits go to private holdings. There's a big difference there. I can't help but feel how unfair it is to make a decision to force a farmer to give up his farm so that someone else can have a job. Please understand that this LNG pipeline is different than other kinds of gas lines in that it is so huge. It is 3 feet wide and requires 120 feet to install the thing. And then after it's in, the farmer has great limitations on how he can use his land once that pipeline is in. Please understand how destructive this is to Oregon. And for what purpose? For speculators to bring a pipeline which would be used for export? How does this benefit Oregonians? Export? In the beginning of LNG, we were supposed to bring in these tankers, and Oregon needed LNG. But now they're talking about the glut of domestic natural gas, which is coming out of hydraulic fracking in Wyoming and other states in the Midwest. We have a glut of domestic gas. Oregonians can use the domestic gas. They don't need this LNG pipeline. So please consider the plight of our farmers and our ranchers and our private property owners, woodlot owners, please consider them in the fast tracking of LNG. If you want a public water line, that's one issue, but private is something else again. Thank you.
Thank you. Last chance. Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2700. Is there anything else to come before the committee today? We are closed for the day.